What's good, everyone? Welcome back to My First Kicks. This is episode 171, and this week I welcome Matt Hatfield to the podcast, and man, what an episode. So I'm very excited to jump into it. But first, let's talk about this crazy episode that I dropped last week. It was such an honor having Bima on, getting able to just hit him with questions that I feel like not many people have asked him. So I hope you guys check out his stuff. And if you haven't yet, hope you check out his episode. If this is your first time listening to this podcast, we are 171 episodes deep in this journey called My First Kicks. And I'm very excited to have y'all on, especially if this is your first time checking it out. So if you aren't familiar, definitely wanted to talk about how this podcast started and where Nice Kicks actually influenced me. And it definitely starts with just my over obsession with sneakers as they were coming out. So I get to talk to Matt about that on this episode and learn about where his obsession for sneakers comes from. So super insightful, super cool. And if you haven't checked out any of the previous episodes and are wondering my first kick story, you're gonna have to check out previous episodes. But enough bantering, because it's interesting to hear when people don't like it, like I've heard, and maybe you'll hear in next week's episode. But on to where you can find Matt. You can find him at nicekicks.com. Also, you can find him at Matt Hatfield, which is MattHatfield. And he's on everything. Super accessible. Hit him up. Leave a comment. Tell him that you listened to this episode and you loved it. Well, hopefully you love it. And you know where to find your boy. I am Who Is Haas on all social medias. Follow the podcast at My First Kicks Pod. Follow the podcast at My First Kicks on TikTok and My First Kicks on YouTube. If you have a My First Kicks story, hit me up. MyFirstKicksPod@gmail.com. I'm going to keep this one short because I want to just jump into this one. But I am still working on trying to figure out the lane of content I want to put out there that accompanies this podcast. It's just a tough road, as you know. I want to be speaking from a point of where I don't compromise myself, I want to say, or not compromise myself, or compromise the podcast more. Because I do want this to be a place where people jump on and tell their stories, and I talk them through it and have conversations through sneakers with this. But at the same time, when I want to make content, I do want to make skits. I do want to make short essays and visuals and something that will pique my interest beyond this podcast. So be on the lookout for some of that as I try to reshape my social medias. But yeah, on to this week's episode with Matt Hatfield. Hey, Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good. You know, this is a long time coming. I feel like I reached out to you when I was like on episode 10. I could look at my messages. I'm not going to do it, but I reached out to you a long time ago.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
No, yeah. Like I said, you know, it's a huge honor to have you on because, you know, I've been a frequent visitor of Nice Kicks and everything that, like, you know, we've messaged back and forth, like recently with the Bred Fours, that whole thing. We definitely talked.
I think they're called the Black Cement Fours, actually. But yes,
I love the back and forth with it. You know, I mean, my explanation, and I talked about it on that episode with JSM and AD Sneaks, I messaged you back, but I realized I messaged you back way too late. You were probably moved on after that. But my explanation behind it is that this is what we in the city of New York, we gave it that like Bred Four because it was like black and red. And I think from there, like it just spread like wildfire.
And when do you remember it in New York City being called the bread fort?
I want to say 2000 and see, I graduated. I'm about to make myself sound so old right now, but I graduated high school in 2008. So mm-hmm. I had to have heard it around 2006 because I stopped cutting school in junior year.
Interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, the first time I had heard it referred to as a bread four was, I think, in the 2008 or nine area. I think probably from the CVP is where, but even then, I think that there was a release shortly after. That was the first time I remember people calling it the bread four.
Mm-hmm.
I actually traced it back, believe it or not. Really actually nerd out over who was the first to publish something by a certain name. So I went down the rabbit hole and found this like D-grade blog called Kicks on Fire. And that was an intentional shot, was the first to call it the bread fours.
Yeah.
And everything before was black cement. Mm-hmm. I mean, you went on to ISS forums, Nike talk, black cement.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I ever heard bread four. Or I'd seen that shoe represented the bread four. The origin of bread is also a funny story too.
Mm.
That one dates back to the 2003, or I first saw it in 2003, the black varsity red,
right,
Jordan 12s.
Mm-hmm.
And someone had written or leaked the colors for upcoming Jordan 12 retros. And somebody put B./V red or mm-hmm. B./ and then capital red. So it was B. And like people were trying to decipher, what is this?
Yeah.
And then people were like, oh my God, this is shoes he wore in the flu game or whatever. But I really think that, you know, when people saw the capital B, a slash, and then a capital R, people just put it all together and started calling it bread. And like, that's where I saw it for the first time ever written.
Yes.
On Nike Talk 2003, attached to the Jordan 12s.
That's so interesting because I definitely want to say I remember, because the reason why I say I know it's high school that I learned it is because there was that moment, because I'm not afraid to ask. I will make myself a fool. I will be like, just so I can learn the answer. And I was like, what the hell does bread mean? And I literally said that. And I remember being a sophomore in high school and being like, because like I was not a big sneakerhead, but I was like, okay, this is like, I wish I had the money for this. Let me just at least study up on this as much as I can. And all the kids in my school were always just wearing Jordans, and then they were just tossing the phrases around, like, you know, UNC bread, and I was just like, what's bread? And then they were like, black and red, and I was just like, ah, that makes sense. And then from then it just kept going, like, that's my knowledge of it.
To me, it was nails on a chalkboard for me, because I was always just like black cement. And then really it was with the Jordan 11, which I always called the playoffs. I knew everybody else called them playoffs. When I heard that shoe called the bread 11s, I wanted to cry. I was like, no, don't you dare do that to this shoe. Like, this has so much history to it. Don't you dare.
Yeah.
And so, but then it's like, it's just like, it's jumped the shark. Now I will say, so you had bread 11.
Yeah.
Then when people were talking about Yeezy colorways and I started hearing people say the blinks, I'm like, this stops right now. Like we used to be a proper country. We used to have public education that was worth a damn. Now you're calling things breads and blinks. Like, what the F is next? Like, this is how democracy dies, okay? We have to put our foot in the sand and say, this is the line. We are not crossing this as a society. Anyways, old man rant.
No, I love it. I love it. But for people who aren't familiar with you, how about you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so my name is Matt Hatfield. I'm 39 years old. I am founder, CEO of Nice Kicks. I've been doing sneakers since I was 16 years old. My first job was working at a shoe store called Athlete's World, started mm-hmm. March 30th, 2001. So just over 23 years ago, and started Nice Kicks in June of 2002.
That's sick, man. Getting flustered of just trying to be like, you don't understand how much I visited. Like maybe 10,000
10,000 clicks alone are just me. Yeah. back when I was on the easy boards, like I don't even know if you've ever spoke like had. I don't even think anybody who's or on easy boards are still either into sneakers, or if they are, they just kept it like straight to the slide. Because like you had to be like, I was on all the easy boards for like Nike Talk, ISS, NSB.org. Like I was on all of that, and
yeah, man,
yeah. It's crazy.
You had to put in so much extra work back then to get information in the easy board era. Like you made a commitment to get that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I call myself, I know the term is like indoor kid, because for the kids that just played inside and had and just stuck on video games, stuff like that. For me, it was video games. But then on top of that, I was like on the message boards, forums, and all the easy boards of just like before everybody started moving the easy boards into actual. Like learning how to do like PHP coding and stuff just to have a forum going. It's absolutely wild.
I'm trying to remember this name of this one easy board. I haven't seen like back in the day. I think it was called Boxton back in the day.
I think
that
I
was
think
another one.
It sounds familiar.
Anyways, yeah.
But it's just huge, like I said, huge honor to have you on here. So you're here to answer the question that I ask everybody each week. And that question is, what's your first kicks? What's that first pair of sneakers you absolutely needed to have?
That first one, I call it the Kickstarter. It was the Reebok Answer One, the Navy Patent colorway.
Mm.
I was in the eighth grade at the time. I had gotten my first pair of shoes that was somewhat associated with a name.
Mm-hmm.
Right before that, like 3 months before, and it was the Air Much More Uptempo or something like, or not Air Much More, Air Hype Uptempo.
Mm.
It was a $65 Champ Sports Finish Line type of shoe, but Scottie Pippen was featured in one of the ads for Champ Sports with a shoe. Now I don't think he ever wore it on court, but they made like a player version or whatever that was sold at retail. And I walked into school and people said like, "Oh my God, you got the Pippins." That was the first time I'd ever like received that. Somebody said a name of a person and my shoes.
I'm like, yeah.
But then it's like, I saw the Answer once. I love that shoe. And I'm like, "Oh, I really want these." And the fact they were truly Iverson shoe. You know, this wasn't like quasi Pippen shoe. No, this was Iverson shoe. And yeah, that pair I had to have.
I think I got the right ones here. But this is they re-retro these in 2022, right? Those ones?
Yes. Yeah. All right. They recently re-retroed them. Yes.
Yeah. I'm going to read a little bit of facts for the listeners here. The 2022 edition, this is, like I said, I'm just reading the reissue of this. The 2022 edition of the Reebok Question Mid Blue Toe brings back an iconic OG colorway of Iverson's debut signature shoe, immortalized in an infamous 1997 game when a rookie AI crossed over Michael Jordan. The mid-top carries a white leather upper with a reinforced tumbled leather toe cap and a bold shade of blue. Reebok's blue vector trademark is outlined in red on the tongue and quarter panel, while the heel tab features the customary question. Did I get the wrong ones?
Yeah. It's okay. It's Answer One. This is so the question was his first signature. This was
ones, yes.
Yes. So this is the Answer One. It's all good. It's all good.
Well, all right. I'm gonna read this one then. I'm gonna read you. All right, my bad. Everybody, rewind back and forget that I said that. I think that this is the right one. Okay, the question returned and the answer fours is coming back. Let's not. Okay, where do you have? Okay, to this day, the Navy patent pairs. Oh, okay. So you don't have an actual excerpt that I can read. So I'm gonna have to
find
that.
Yeah, this is. Yeah, this one, and actually I'm like noticing it right now. This was a post in 2012 when I don't think they'd ever come back. And I just caught an error where the author said they released in 97. This colorway released in 98. So even I'm actually hopping in to make an edit right now on this old post.
Oh my God.
I feel very responsible for this to be accurate here. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Okay. So let me see. I got it. Here we go. This is Iverson's second signature shoe, correct?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
here we go. Allen Iverson's second signature shoe, the Answer 1 DMX-10, was the first basketball sneaker utilizing Reebok's moving air technology. This version is built with a blue patent leather upper, hidden lacing, and a mesh inner booty. Iverson's name is spelled on the tongue, and his iconic jewel emblem appears on the heel, a cushioned midsole and gold flecked rubber outsole are situated underfoot for impact protection and durability.
Yep,
I got it.
That's beautiful one. Okay, beautiful.
That shoe out here, I think the white and black pair. Is it the black and white pair that got the DMX commercial? It's like, I feel like DMX is in a commercial, right?
I honestly don't recall on the different commercials. That'd be Caleb on my team with all those. The black white was the primarily, that was the lead colorway in 97. And that one got the most marketing push behind it.
Yeah.
Is that
the one with Jadakiss, right? Jadakiss
was in the, I think that was the Answer 5 or 4. I think it was the 5.
Yeah.
But the Answer 4 was by far, I mean, I think of that as like, that's the Iverson. I know like people like love the question. They think like the question's timeless and whatever, like he crossed Michael. And I think of the Answer 4 as the ultimate of all ultimate Iverson shoes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was growing up, I wish I was able to get a pair of Iversons. I feel like the price point was a little bit too high, right? Like 140 was there? Retail?
I lived in Canada at the time. I don't remember. I think they were 125. I think we sold them at Athletes World for 189, which works out to about that 125 mark.
Okay.
Currency.
You were originally raised in born and raised in Canada?
Sorry. Canada? Yeah, my backstory. So I was born and raised in Fresno, California. Mm-hmm. Both my parents are American. And then we lived in the Caribbean for a little bit during high school. And then I finished high school in Victoria, BC in Canada.
Wow. Is there a reason why you moved around so much?
I mean, my parents were professors and they took a teaching gig down in the Caribbean, and then my dad needed heart surgery, so we needed to move back to America. And actually the day we were moving to the Caribbean, we got acceptance letters to emigrate to Canada. So we're like, okay, we're not going to leave the university high and dry here. Like, we got to come down. So
that's cool. That's wild. What is it like having professors as parents?
I mean, it's a definitely unique experience. I think the pluses are that like education from an early age was really like just like second nature and pushed. It just like was natural. The downside of being a child of two professors is looking them in the eye and telling them I'm dropping out of school and I don't think I need this. And, you know, I'm going to do my own thing. That was not the easiest conversation to have. And for years, it was subtly nudged to me, you know, you can always go back, right? You know, you can always go get your degree, right? And coincidentally, I actually dropped out the same like month that Kanye's College Dropout album came out.
Yeah.
He had a line in there, which was like, they ask, have you graduated? No, I decided I was finished. It was his response. And like, I used that line forever. It's like, no, I decided I was finished with college at that time.
That's wild. Were you going to school for like journalism or anything that's in this?
No, not at all. No. I originally went to school for biochemistry and then chemistry. Mm-hmm. And then I swapped over to software engineering. Yeah. I mean, if I had followed my path, like what I'd wanted to do in high school, it was going to be down like law. Like that's what I was first like really into, but no, nothing journalism at all. I didn't know anything about journalism. I give a lot of praise to Joe LaPuma, who's an actual journalism graduate who, you know, from UConn, a really good school in this too. He helped teach me so many things back in the early days. Just talking with him about how process is done.
I mean, that's sick. That's sick. When at one point, I mean, you talked about, you know, getting the Reebok, I'm going to say it wrong, the Reebok answers. I keep always saying Reebok questions, but you talk about the Reebok answers. Like, did your STEM or like, did you start getting like, okay, I need to figure out more about sneakers from there? Or was it just like your atmosphere around you?
It was 1,000% my atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So I went to a unique school in Fresno, California, where it was a mix of an accelerated program as well as just, you know, just standard high school. And the area of town that I was in was, you know, it was very different from the upbringing I had in the suburbs. And I learned quickly, like, sneakers were a real big deal. And I had started getting East Bay catalogs in the mail from ever since I did like wrestling in middle school. I was on their list. And what I would do is like, I just liked looking at the shoes, and I don't like, if I have interest in something, I don't just like look at it. Like I study the shit out of it. So I had to memorize the name of every single shoe and understand the cushioning systems that were in each and where the cushioning was placed. Like they used to have all those nice little diagrams. But anyways, my thing was, I found that I could break the ice with almost anybody by talking about their shoes.
Welcome to the podcast.
Exactly. So I learned that shoes were this amazing icebreaker. And then it was a way that I could also remember people too. So I didn't remember everybody's names, but like I could like make visual identification with who has what shoes. And I'm like, oh, I know which person you're talking about. But like it really like shoes really became a big deal for me when my family moved to the Caribbean and I had the last shot Jordan 14s. They were almost all black. So the schoolmaster let me like wear that shoe to school and with uniform. And like my classmates lost their minds because that was the first time they ever got to see the Jordan 14 in person. And this is like almost a year after it came out. But I noticed when I walked in and all these kids my age, the Caribbean, like were into this, I was like, oh my gosh, this sneaker thing is, this is not just like a little American thing. This is global. So I think like it was kind of through sneakers, I discovered more about people, you know, than anything. So,
yeah, it's so crazy how, you know, sneakers just like link up with, because once you compliment somebody on their sneakers, I feel like it instantly opens to them being like, yo, you got to know how I got these. And that turns into something else, you know?
Yes.
So the idea of just being like, yo, these Jordan 14s, have you seen him, saw him? Like, they're like, how do you think he got them? Like, immediately it's always like everybody's brains just start sparking and you start working together, figuring out, you know? And it's so sick that you're able to like, you know, branch out from that on top of that, you know? Like, but I also, it's funny because your method is similar to my method, but I always ask for people's full names. And that's how I remember people's names. So
that's a good one.
So
it's a good one.
Cause usually like the first name either has like the first name is usually something a little bit easier, but then because the last name is so different that you can just be like, okay, your name is Matt Hatfield. And then be like, all right, now I got it. You know, but that's my little trick. So like getting a taste of, the question I want to ask, but I know it's like, I want to like this Sam, Fresno, right, has a specific sneaker culture, right? And now that you've been studying sneaker culture for so long, like I want to know like what is the differences that you've seen in your starting of seeing sneaker culture around you in Fresno versus like studying sneaker culture over these past years.
I mean, to be honest, like in Fresno, there wasn't really much of a sneaker culture in a lot of places. I mean, there were only like two or three high schools in Fresno where people cared about sneakers. You know, a lot of times people just, they wore whatever kind of thing. It's like whatever was like fashionably trendy at the time. But sneakers meant a big deal to folks at Edison, for sure, at my Edison High School in Fresno, California. What I've seen change in my life, it's insane. I mean, you have to remember in Fresno, we had one mall that had sneakers. We had a World Foot Locker. That was the big deal. And we did get Adjust for Feet. That was definitely another big deal. But then other than that, it was all sporting goods or clearance channels like Big Five.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a big sneaker scene there. And then also too, like in the Caribbean, like the only shoes that were there were ones that people bought in the United States and then brought down. So they were either extremely expensive or they were old models of shoes. And then in Canada, like I lived in a small town, so I didn't get like access to all the greatest stuff ever either. what I found when I started really working in this space was, as I traveled different places, I saw that each sneaker scene in each city was very different. And this was at the earlier part of my career. Now I think it's much more pretty much the same everywhere you go. Mm-hmm. But there was a time where a shelf in New York City looked very different from a shelf in a sneaker space in LA that looked very different from a place in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. You had completely different assortments of shoes. There might have been some overlapping models here and there, but like, you were going to find probably as many Bo Jacksons in an Atlanta sneaker shop as you would Air Forces up in New York, as you would Cortez's and Chuck's in LA. Mm-hmm. It was very different, much more regional flavor to stuff. Now things are, I don't want to say monoculture, that's not the right term, but it is much more flat in terms of what the assortment and style is.
I totally agree with you, because I think now that the invention of the internet or whatever, like now that the culture or streetwear culture in general, just like fashion, just like spreads out so fast that everybody's trying to be on trend at all times, it loses the city identity. I mean, we still have like versions of it, but it's interesting because before it was, yes, we had the internet, but still people were, it like you can identify who's from where, you know, just by straight off as just style.
Well, and I think what it is it's what's the source of the influence and inspiration. So like, mm-hmm. I think earlier on, you know, 15 years ago, right? The internet covered what was happening in a lot of places and ideas were able to spread through the internet. But now I think the ideas of influence are like those inspiration points are happening on the internet for mm-hmm. way more than ever. And because of that, you know, regional stuff just doesn't have the same influence. You can kind of get a little taste of where the source of inspiration is. Is it from a certain type of individual? Is it from a certain type of fashion or music mm-hmm. Today? But it's funny because I think that we went from an era where we had an extremely big long tail in mm-hmm. internet and fashion and sneakers. And we've now actually gone back to a shorter tail to kind of what we saw in the late 90s and early 2000s. And I think that part of the reason that we're seeing this phenomenon is the long tail of the web has now been shortened by algorithms mm-hmm. because it like what matters so much is reach and visibility. So we're seeing some pieces of content and some individuals get a disproportionate share of voice and visibility and influence mm-hmm. than we did in years past. So I think that's why today, like you go to some high schools and it's like, wow, this feels like the click era of the 90s. Mm-hmm. There's your goths, there's your punks, there's your skater there. You know, like you have really distinct styles. And I even think like some high schools I see today, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like every freaking male has broccoli hair, like flannel pajama pants and mm-hmm. Crocs. I'm like, this is insane to see because it hasn't been like this in a long time where you have so many people in youth dressing very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. It's absolutely wild. I mean, it's funny you said broccoli hair and immediately thought about Justin Timberlake.
Oh my gosh. He was the OG, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Immediately. He kept his curls a little tighter, though. Yes.
I mean, it's wild. I mean, there was that one point where a lot of kids were doing like blonde, half black hair or something like that for a little bit. Yeah. Like it was like that like dirty blonde is what I was starting to say.
Oh, dirty. Blonde. Listen. You comb the internet, you'll find some frosted tip era of Matt. That was there.
All right. So like, at what point, because we talked about a lot of your back history, like at what point were you like, all right, sneakers is it, like I'm going to dive full head first into it?
I mean, it really like right off the bat, I just went in. The point of no turning back for me was when I did drop out of college. Like I was like, okay, this is going to be my thing, at least for quite a while.
Was there something that was like, Was there like a moment where it was like, all right, I need to do, like, I need to jump in. I can't do half in, half out. Or was it just like, nah, I'm going gung-ho, like, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I knew pretty quickly into first year that, I mean, my grades were not great in first year of university. And that was definitely an indicator that this might not be a thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And by mid part of second year, I knew like, yeah, no, like I could see like my heart and mind was going to the business and going to sneakers. It wasn't going towards school.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew like I was not giving my business what it deserved by trying to be half in, half out. I also wasn't giving school what it deserved. You know, it's like, it would be better for me to go back mm-hmm. later and actually take it seriously than to try to like halfway through it. So that's when I decided.
And then you didn't just start Nice Kicks off.
I first started while I was still in high school. So mm-hmm. I was able to straddle both.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Yeah.
And then from there, it just like, it grew exponentially, I will say, because I feel like when I was early on reading it, you know, you had Kicks on Fire, you mentioned, and then it was like
it came after, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking about when I started reading.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
I'm talking about when you started it. And then the expansion of just sneaker media, right?
Yeah, like, for sure.
Just that crazy boom. And after that it's grown, as I said, exponentially. But where was your foresight to be like, you know what, this is the move, I'm gonna start it up? And then be like, because as you said, like, you know, you are part of the reason why it's expanded so fast. So yeah,
I mean, I think that I had the foresight on the format of blogs. Mm-hmm. And what it was again, it was observing my own patterns and my own behaviors. I spent a lot of time on sneaker forums.
Mm-hmm.
I also spent a lot of time reading blogs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, wait a second, what if we put these two together here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I saw that it was actually really hard to find information on sneaker forums.
Yeah.
And it wasn't by any fault of the users. It was by purely the design of the product.
Mm-hmm.
And if you weren't a really, really regular user of it, it was hard to come and go and get information.
Mm-hmm.
It was also really hard to know unless you were a very, very, you know, regular user who was giving information that was credible and who wasn't. You know, you couldn't just go, oh, how many posts does this person have? Does that give you credibility? Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. Are they a certain forum on? Does that make them credible? Or no, not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was reading a lot of blogs like TechCrunch was one. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones that I was, you know, Wired. There were quite a few like tech blogs that I read, and I was like, okay, this should be it for sneakers. Like, we should have that. And 2005, Hypebeast and High Snobiety, which was on a Blogspot at that time,
mm-hmm.
were up, and they were a combination of sneakers and streetwear. Coincidentally, I actually lived only like a mile or so from Kevin Ma at Hypebeast while I was reading his site. But I thought like, okay, these sites are good, but I'm not so into the streetwear.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not all that, like, I think vinyl toys are cool. I'm not going to be writing about these things. And like the street art, like, yeah, I really liked it, but I just felt like there was a need for people who were like myself, who really cared about not just sneakers, but the stories behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what made me think, okay, no, make a blog purely about sneakers and upcoming shoes.
What, like, when, as you were starting, what was the reception? And then, like, how did it feel once you noticed that there's a community building being built behind this as well?
Well, I knew there was a community already because I'd spent all the time on the forum. So I knew how big sneaker culture was.
I mean, like, then, just like a Nice Kicks community. You know?
Oh, yeah. So I built a Nice Kicks community in like 2006, early 2007 on Drupal. Mm-hmm. But before that, it was just using WordPress. But my approach to community was, I had two things. First was MySpace. Second thing was comment section. Now, the other players in the space were not doing comment sections. I don't think High Snob had him. I know Hypebeast didn't. He was on Movable Type. Mm-hmm. And I built on WordPress, and I wanted a comment section. So I thought like it was really important for people to converse back and forth and share their thoughts on products. And this was before comment sections even had threading. So mm-hmm. it took work to use a comment section to ask questions back and forth between people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that led a lot to the growth in the beginning was the comments, and then also to our early SEO work, making sure we ranked for what people were looking for.
No, yeah. I mean, the comment section was legendary. You'd had random people pulling up and comment and be like, yo, DJ Clark Kent responded to me. Like, you'd be like, yeah. Whoa, like, yeah. it was crazy with time.
It was wild. And we actually, there were times like we kind of had to kickstart, I think in the first couple posts or whatever, like there were some organic comments, but we actually, I did some ghostwriting of comments to create some dialogue. Like because I knew that there was this cold start problem with comments. If you mm-hmm. didn't see a comment in there, it was much less likely you would be the first one to comment. Mm-hmm. So I often like, if it was a topic of a shoe that I was like, I don't know how people are going to feel, I would ghostwrite like 4 to 5 comments of different perspectives just to make people feel more comfortable that they could jump in there and feel free to speak their mind about mm-hmm. the shoes.
It's like a kid's dance. Somebody's got to start dancing.
or if you're a good promoter, mm-hmm. you have a crew of people dancers who go to your parties because mm-hmm. then everybody talks about how that promoters' parties are the best. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because they got the party started from the jump with dancers there.
Yeah, I feel like you've been in legendary rooms because of Nice Kicks. So like, do you have any crazy stories of like, I can't believe this brought me here?
Oh yes. Quite a few. Mm-hmm. Quite a few. One of the craziest moments ever was when I was in China in 2018 on a tour with Anta and Clay Thompson. Mm-hmm. And there were some kids at the restaurant who were talking to somebody in our group, and they were, asking who I was, what we were doing, all that kind of stuff. And the person mentioned like, oh, he's the guy who runs Nice Kicks. And the kid's like eyes like lit up. Again, I don't understand. I don't speak Mandarin, so I don't know anything. But then I heard Nice Kicks. I'm like, oh, they're saying something about it. So I'm like, but like the kid like looked up and his eyes got like super big. He couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And he pulls out his phone. He pulls up Instagram, which by the way is banned in China, mm-hmm. and holds up his phone to show that he's following Nice Kicks. And it was just like this really surreal thing mm-hmm. to be literally halfway around the globe and then meeting somebody who's like just so over the moon to meet me because he follows us on Instagram. Like that was a very, very surreal thing for sure.
That's wild. First of all, you probably just got him arrested. He's being taken away.
We haven't heard from him since.
Yeah. It's like, how dare you have Instagram?
Yeah.
But that's absolutely nuts. You know, I never think about how far something, cause like, you know, how far all this stuff has reach, right? Like the internet is a crazy place, and it's also a small place at the same time. So it's so wild for you to just have an impact on this kid as well, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you talk about that instance, but like, you know, is there an instance where like you've seen the sneaker culture get portrayed like especially overseas, like the way, because it's such an American based thing, mm-hmm. right? Where have you seen sneaker culture just like make a huge impact and seeing it firsthand for you, and like how shock was it for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really crazy to see when every once in a while we'll pull up the analytics of just like how many countries we've reached mm-hmm. in the past 365 days. And it really is humbling that it's like every territory mm-hmm. and country other than like North Korea or places that like can't have internet. That to me is just incredible. You know, like, yes, maybe they're using bot farms in some of these countries to do it. I don't know. But like that to me is hard to put into words to see that. I think also too, like we just saw a stat where it was our the number of people we reached in the last 90 days on Instagram. And we looked at the number and I was like, just how big is that? And I looked at the populations of different countries in the world. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this would be the 17th largest country in the world, right? Jeez. Behind Italy. Of people who have engaged with Nice Kicks content just on Instagram in the last 3 months.
It's wild.
And that to like, that's the thing. Like sometimes it's so easy when you're working in tech and working in web to like lose perspective of just what these numbers actually represent. These are humans. These are people and their time spending with your brand. Yeah. It's really humbling to see that.
No. Sure. Yeah. That, I mean, that's sick. I mean, sometimes I'm like, who's listening in Australia? Like why? Yeah. Shout out to you. I've wanted to ask, like, as I thought about this, the idea of just starting like content in general, right? The idea of writing, I feel like it's kind of gone lost, right? And in terms of just not many people are doing it, they're more just regurgitating instead of being like, hey, this is what I think about something. And, you know, these are the facts that are laid out for us. But like over these years, you know, and you've seen either, I don't know if you want to say the degradation of writing or of journalism, but like, what have you seen that gives you hope in terms of just like sneaker content in the form of writing and journalism?
Yeah. I think it's a really good question because I think this actually reaches far beyond sneakers. What is the future and significance of journalism and storytelling? I think that writing matters. And I think that sometimes we make the mistake of thinking writing is only presented in text form. I think they're like the best shows we see, the best movies, the best podcasts all have an insane level of writing that goes into them. And I think that, so I think like the art is not lost. I think it's kind of reshaped into different ways. I do think that we have either approached or like we've already hit, or we are getting very close to peak social in terms of how we want our consumption of our content. I myself find that I'm spending far more time getting my information from knowledgeable individuals in podcast form and written form. I don't think it's going to be I don't think it's gonna be a far off thing that we're going to want to put our phones down and consume even more content in written format. So, you know, like the trend line can only go up so far. Right. And, you know, a lot of VCs in Silicon Valley would think that, you know, while screen time might be at 8 hours a day, maybe we can get all these kids to spend 36 hours a day on social media, but like, guess what? That's not possible. So I really think we have already hit what is likely to be the peak, especially as there's much more conversation coming out about the harmful effects of spending too much time online and on social media. I think you're not going to quash people's level of curiosity. Right. That's not going to happen there. But so that level of interest and curiosity is probably going to go away from doom scrolling over to other places. My long-term prediction is it'll go into some written forms.
Interesting. Cause I mean, you just made me think about the idea. Cause I'm always a person who just thinks more, right? So like, I mean, we talk about the breads, like I will tunnel my brain. Like I will literally be like, okay, let me go back, and then keep going back. And so that idea, I feel like people don't understand that like having their phone is like having a library in your hand, but it's like a library that it's like a choose your own adventure library where you can end up going to the wrong side of the story instead of the right side of the story.
Yeah, I mean, you can have some of the best pieces of art in your pocket or something that makes the National Enquirer looks like it should be in the Smithsonian. I mean, like, you have every end of the spectrum, you know, both ends of the spectrum on in terms of quality of content there, for sure.
So speaking on my curiosity, but where does your curiosity come from? Like, where did it stem from?
I think that honestly, that's something that maybe just naturally came from my parents, mm-hmm. just like observing them. I don't know. I've always had this thirst and this hunger to learn more about things. I was never satisfied as a kid with just what was presented to me mm-hmm. in any book. I need, and so like when we got the internet, when I was in the eighth grade. Oh my God. I couldn't believe how awesome it was to be able to read about stuff that mm-hmm. I couldn't find any information on at my, like my high school or my middle school library. Like mm-hmm. I remember when we were moving to the Caribbean, we were moving to the island of Grenada. We had an encyclopedia that had a little write-up about Grenada. Mm-hmm. And we had one or two copies of National Geographic that talked about the Grenada invasion in my high school library. And that was it.
Yeah.
So I went onto the internet trying to read absolutely everything I possibly could, which at that time there wasn't a lot, but it was so much more immense mm-hmm. than what I could get locally. I think that's, if I look back at it, that was really a big tipping point for me in terms of like this appetite I have for learning can be satiated by the internet much better than it can just like whatever is available to me locally.
No, yeah. It's just interesting because I've been trying to get into that lane of like video essays. I mean, we talk about different types of ways of writing, and I'm trying to get into video essays in terms of just like sneakers and streetwear, stuff that interests me. And it's like the research that you have to do, but it's also just like, am I conveying this correctly? Am I putting in the effort that I want to do and like, have I unraveled the threads enough to that it actually satiates me, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if mm-hmm. that's the same writing style for you when you write your articles. Because, I mean, I remember, when I first reached out to you, it was either the Zade Kicks.
Yes.
you were writing about Zade Kicks.
Yep.
But I know, like, reading your stuff for years, like, I know that you do immense amount of research. So, like, what are your methods and like, how do you figure out your ways to, like, all right, I've unraveled this enough?
Yeah, I mean, the Zade definitely is one of my favorite projects I've ever worked on. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate my soon-to-be wife for putting up with me during those like weeks where I was working insane hours,
yeah,
reading, researching, on the phone, doing everything, even going to Oregon to get mm-hmm. on the ground to get information about this case. That was the first time I really felt like I was just all in on a story.
Let me just say, I picture you with the press hat. You're just there like, can I get a word with you, sir? Sir.
I mean, it was something else. That whole project, mm-hmm. And I'm still working on it. That story's not done. I'm still working on it. And I haven't published anything else. But Zade Kicks was just the start. Mm-hmm. This touches so many more stories that we have seen that people don't realize there's a connection to. I can't wait to get that out there. But anyways, look,
you should. Pile it all together, and you should put out a book. That's what you should do.
I honestly think I will. I mean, yeah. Like I probably will in the end. And honestly, like I speaking of book, like that was something I'd been wanting to do a book for Shoes for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. The thing that I guess that I stumbled into with the book project is like I found that a lot of the stuff I was just basically regurgitating marketing speak mm-hmm. from a lot of the brands, whereas like I felt like this was the first story that you really got something deeper than Shoes with.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I have this whole take on resellers, and mm-hmm. I think you know, these resale shops that were popping up all like around the cities and stuff like that, I think they're just fronts. And like, you know, like I have like my little red line theories and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I can confirm that your theory is dead on. A lot of these things were I mean, all you had to do was watch one or two seasons of Ozark and it'll open your eyes to a lot of the stuff that was going on.
I mean, it's wild. I don't know. 2020 like made like either open up a ton of people's eyes on some stuff or just be like, I'm gonna just get what I want and it's gonna be easier for me. But you're like, but I don't know, like if this, like you're just like, I was contemplating way too much or thinking about this stuff way too much. I don't know if it's just like being inside the house for too much, but the idea of just, it just came out a little bit too, I don't know. For me, sneakers is, like I said, I've always been saying it, it's a culture and not many people believe that. But I do think you put in what you get back, and especially with something like that. And, you know, if you put in passion, you're going to get passion back. And that's either, that can come in the form of negativity or come in the form of positivity. It's always going to be a circle, because as most things in life are, circles. And so that idea of like, oh, we got to get these people out, but it's like, how are we going to get these people out? And it's like, yeah, we can't, if sneakers are mainstream and people need money and you want money, and now, you know, it's just a circle. So
I mean I get it. Like, trust me, I was very frustrated for many years. Like, I really saw sneakers changing in a way I didn't like going, like starting in 2012, 2013 is really when I saw it starting up. And then it just got worse and worse, it seemed like every year. But I will say what I've learned is the best way to do it is just be true to yourself. Mm-hmm. Be true to what you like with sneakers. Walk the walk of what's important to you. And what is the best part of it is the people who share in that same kind of mindset, you draw them in naturally. And very quickly, you can build a community of people who really like sneakers the same way you do. And you can kind of just ignore the noise. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of just like, it's all that resale nonsense is kind of just on the periphery for me. Mm-hmm. I don't really cross paths with it much anymore. And I really enjoy it like that too.
I'm the same way. I've never been, I mean, I got called an old head the other day because apparently I have old head tendencies because I don't pay resale. And I'm just like, I'm fine missing out on the shoe. That's different than being like, no, never again. It's like, if I see, my thing is, and I don't know if you think about it this way. When I look at a shoe, I think of a price. And if the price matches of like, okay, I'm cool with paying that much, I will pay that much. And that, I feel like that's like the way we should do it. We do it with everything. We do it with furniture. Like, I'm not going to pay $2,000 for a couch when I feel like when I sat down on it, that's a $1,500 couch or a $1,000 couch. I'm not going to do that. Like, it doesn't feel that way to me. So I don't know where that's gone.
I think for me, like, I always grew up never having like super nice, expensive things. I've always taken like more pleasure in the stuff that other people slept on and having something that was really special to me. And if anything, people are like looking down like, man, which ones are those? Like, and it's like, oh yeah, you and like the rest of the world pass on them. But you know, I have them.
Yeah.
You know, like it's, I have always kind of liked that kind of thing. And that goes for, that's not just shoes. Like, that's furniture, cars, you know, all that.
No, yeah, it's like feng shui. The way of the feng shui is like, I don't know, I'm saying it wrong. but you know what
the
I mean.
The shui of the feng,
the shung of the fei. The way that I feel like your body is like, yo, this is the positive energy I need. Let me get that. Mm-hmm. Let me get those. Let me get this. Oh, I love this shoe. The hidden Asics are coming out. Oh, I really want that shoe. Like, I feel like because of that, like, energy that I'm like, all right, this is it. But, you know, I don't know. Some people just see it as only monetary. I know that I always say it's social currency. And, but I think people take it differently. It's like social currency of like, oh, this is the hierarchy. Oh, I got the heat. Now I'm at the top of the social ladder. No, I say social currency is because I can start a conversation with these. If I'm wearing I wore the acronym Blazers today. If somebody stopped me like, yo, those shoes are crazy. Now I can start this conversation and see where it goes. Let me learn about this person. Like, that's how I treat it as social currency.
I agree with you there. I'm the same way with especially vintage shoes. Like, I have a lot of vintage ones and vintage ads that I collect. And I'm really thankful for the people I've gotten to meet because they know I am into this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. and I know they're into this kind of stuff. And it's really cool to have conversations with individuals about, you know, anything, but because we first connected over a shared interest in something unique mm-hmm. is why we've now met.
So. Yeah. So hard pivot, because this is mm-hmm. probably you maybe have never been asked this on a sneaker podcast, but I want to learn about, because we talk about this in DMs, your health journey, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've recently lost a ton of weight and got back into, like, I was doing CrossFit very heavily. So I got mm-hmm. recently into just working out again and getting back into the groove of that. But I wanted to learn about how'd you get to where you're at, where you're doing the craziest of workouts. So what was that journey like for you? Because I feel like I think I saw that one post you put about making that switch, but I wanted to know how'd you get there.
Yeah. So, I mean, so it was, I started on it about 7 years ago, mm-hmm. In the end of, or back half of 2017. Really what it was, the thing that was the wake up call for me, is I started to lose sensation in my legs. Mm. What I knew was pre-diabetic nerve damage. Mm-hmm. And I knew I was not taking care of myself. Like, I knew that for years. Mm-hmm. And I had always just said, no, I'll do it later. I'm putting this first, putting that first. And then I think when that happened, I knew that I was getting close to that point of no return. And I knew that, like, I might not have a chance to get better if mm-hmm. I keep pushing this. So that was a big wake up call for me. And I wanted to, like, I actually had to start by diet change. Mm-hmm. And because I was too heavy to exercise, I was 320 pounds.
Wow.
And I remember I went for a walk one time, like 4 miles, and oh my God, my feet were just destroyed. My mm-hmm. back was so sore. My leg, like every part of me was wrecked. Mm-hmm. I could barely move for a couple of days from that. I'm like, oh gosh, I am going to have to like take a different approach to this. So I had mm-hmm. to first change diet to lose at least 20 or 30 pounds. And then just slow, you know, crawl, walk, run. It was starting with walking 15 minutes, walking 20 minutes, you know, increasing the amount of time. And then, you know, maybe increasing a little bit of the, what's it called? The incline a little mm-hmm. bit on the treadmill. And then mm-hmm. my brother had told me, like, you should set a goal for yourself to try something. So I like found this upcoming 5K that I registered for. And this mm-hmm. was quite a few months out. And I'm like, okay, this gives me enough time to try to get moving forward, and I'll walk it if I can't run at all. And so I started mixing in a little bit of jogging here, you know, like be on the treadmill 5 minutes and try to jog for 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. And like just try to slowly increase the time. But yeah, I was able to lose, you know, peak to valley, 142 pounds.
Wow.
And now I'm, you know, fitness is really a big part of my life. Mm-hmm. I wake up every morning, usually either hitting the gym or hitting the road to run every morning. And mm-hmm. what I think is the greatest part I share with everybody is that the changes that you see aren't the best part. It's how I feel. It's how I think. Mm-hmm. It is really like, I can't put into words how much it's changed my life and quality of life by prioritizing health.
Man, I mean, I love it. I've always had a struggle with weight. If you've watched older episodes of this podcast, you will see the difference. So shout out to you if this is your first time listening to this podcast. I have not looked like this the entire time. But, you know, I had my struggles a little bit different in terms of just like, I've tried everything, and I was doing CrossFit 5 to 6 days a week. And mm-hmm. I think I was doing CrossFit to the point where like I still could not lose weight. Like I was 280 for mm-hmm. so long. And I had to finally, I mean, I guess I'll announce it on here, but like I was pre-diabetic and end up having to, after pandemic just fucked me up bad. And so I got up to like my heaviest was like 350. And mm-hmm. from there, I got like, I was super pre-diabetic to the point they were like, hey, we might have to put you on insulin. I was just like, this is not happening.
We're going to fight this. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I ended up having to get weight loss surgery in order to get that, like, my metabolism to reset, because my metabolism was so bad. But, and I've always been big. Like, I don't, you talked about you were wrestling. I know you're probably, you had to make weight. You had to do all this stuff that the, like, messes with your metabolism and stuff.
Seventh grade, I was able to make weight a little bit better.
Yeah. But I, like, I've never been skinny. That's the thing, right? So I'm still not skinny now, but, you know, I had to take these drastic measures, and I wish I never had to do that, but not everybody's born with the genetics to be able to, you know, fight that, like, slow metabolism. Or, like, I was doing the crazy diets, and the diets were like, they would work here and there, they wouldn't work, and it was just like, all right, now it's time.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, so through my process, like, learning about food and nutrition, water and sleep, oh my gosh, that really is, like, the big hack that I think is not talked about nearly enough. I mean, I live a very different life. Like, I don't drink, don't use any type of drugs, no pharmaceuticals. I will have coffee, but I try to limit caffeine intake. Mm-hmm. I am always drinking water and primarily vegetarian. I will eat meat here and there, but, like, yeah, I mean, some people think it's, like, restrictive, but it's funny. Like, you actually just start going, and after 3 weeks time, you it's like your body forgets some of this stuff. Like, you're just like, this is the new normal.
Mm-hmm.
Just like waking up.
But, yeah. No, but, yeah. I mean, shout out to you big time, you know.
Thank you.
It's wild. And then, you posted this crazy workout that Lance Armstrong was doing. I was like, I can't do that.
Oh, man. Acid bath. That thing's nuts. That dude. Yeah. So I compete in this sport called High Rocks. It is similar. Like, a lot of people draw comparisons to CrossFit. I say it's going to pass CrossFit and make CrossFit a small thing one day. But I encourage everybody, look it up. If you're ever looking for a good challenge, High Rocks is it. It is such a great sport, an amazing community.
Yeah. I mean, I'll try it one time. I don't know. It looks crazy. Because I think the workout, I was like, whoa, this is crazy. It was like, was it like 100 meter row? Not row. It was a ski. I know it was something with the ski. Or it was like
1,000 meter ski.
1,000 meter ski.
Yeah. So that's about like 4-something minutes. Yeah. 1,000 meter row. It's close to 4 minutes. And the 8 kilometers of running, but they're all 1 kilometer segments. Sled push, sled pull. Burpee broad jumps, farmer carry, weighted lunges, then 100 wall balls to finish it.
One day I'm going to come out and we'll work out with you. We'll see if I die at the end of it. But now we're at the end of the podcast, and so I ask another question before we jump off. And that question deals with a little bit of visualization. So I want you to think back to the time where you were a young kid about to open that box of the answer ones. I was about to say question ones again, but the answer ones. Now you travel back in time behind yourself. What would you tell your younger self as they open that box?
You have no idea how these shoes are going to change your life. You have no idea, kid. No idea.
Man, that's absolutely wild. And thank you again for jumping on, Matt. And for everybody out there, you know what we say each week, wear your kicks. Peace.